The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame.
Africans at home and throughout the diaspora, unity is strength. We got the power. In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
fighting. Right now, right now.
Now it's time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Right now.
And it is right now that we got to do it right, y'all. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And today I want to remind you, as I always do, we have a serial liar and a 34-count felon in the White House that is causing havoc, not just on this country, but on the world. And so we need to remember that we got pressure to put on him and our elected officials. But Congress also has the option of Amendment 26. And so we want them to invoke that, because clearly this man is unhinged. And we now are in war with Iran. And so this is uncharted territory for us. But, you know, we have to keep our eye on the prize, and we also have to get more organized and more strategically organized, because there is a lot at stake. Today, just because it happened on the heels of Iran, but we've been watching as this country has moved to militarization of the police, the use of the military in communities. We saw this happening in L.A. recently, to the tune of, you know, overreach of the president's power. He basically, you know, stepped over the mayor and the governor of California to do what he thought he should do as the strong arm, and flexed his muscles, and the courts agreed that he had the right to do that. So what we're seeing, you all, is just lawlessness at levels that we've never seen before. And some of this is going to come out more and more as we unfold, but let's pay attention. Let's pay attention. And we got somebody who has been paying attention to this thing for a very long time. We have Michael McPherson, who some of you all might recognize that name, because he is originally from St. Louis, but we have loaned him to Seattle for a minute. And so for those of you who were around for the Ferguson Uprising, Michael McPherson was one of the co-chairs of Hands Up. And Hands Up Don't, well, what was it? The Coalition? Yeah,
Don't Shoot.
Don't Shoot Coalition, where we really try to bring some order and some structure and some strategy to the Ferguson Uprisings. And I think we did, and, you know, trying to provide some amount of structure to that uprising that was successful, because it's one of the longest running protests in modern day U.S. history. And so I think we did that, and we still are assessing the successes of that uprising, and I think that might go on for a while. But welcome to the show, Michael McPherson.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Hello to everyone, especially people in St. Louis. Now, I'm originally from North Carolina, but I did live in St. Louis for about 20-something years. So in many ways, I'm a St. Louisan as well.
Yeah. And so you know the dynamics here. You know all the nuances. So, yeah, doesn't take long to figure that part out, does it, Michael? So tell us.
I do love St. Louis.
Yeah. It's a place where there's lots of opportunities for growth and progress if we get the right people at the table. So I do want to talk about veterans for, for Peace, because I've been thinking more about them when I saw the Marines unleashed on LA, and I saw not just former veterans, but people specifically in the Marines that were coming out and say, this is just wrong. This is wrong. This is not what we're supposed to be doing. And oftentimes I don't think people realize that there's people serving who don't always agree with American policy, particularly military policy. Talk a bit about what Veterans for Peace does and how it organizes so that people understand the real deal with the military and also how our dollars are being spent.
Yeah, sure. So first off, Veterans for Peace was started in 1985. So this is our 40th year that we have been an organization, and it was originally started. The vision of it was started by a Vietnam era veteran whose brother died in Vietnam, and other veterans, because of their experiences. Some of the impetus for it being started was what our U.S. foreign policy in Central and Latin America, because we have a long history of intervening in that part of the world, as well as the proliferation of nuclear weapons, which has a lot to do with what has happened between Israel and Iran. So there's been 40 years of VFP standing up and saying that we need to abolish nuclear weapons. And I want to make that clear. You know, people talk about Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapons. Well, Israel does have nuclear weapons. And whether or not Iran is trying to or not to get nuclear weapons, which analysts say that they are not or were not, you have a neighbor who doesn't like you that has a big weapon, you might look to get a similar weapon to protect yourself. So one of the things Veterans for Peace believes is that we need to abolish all nuclear weapons so that, you know, we don't have conflicts between each other about who should have nuclear weapons and who shouldn't. So it's been 40 years of us as an organization working to abolish nuclear weapons and to change U.S. foreign policy to one that, instead of using war and force as a major instrument, we would really like to abolish war, but at least let's move towards where it's the last option instead of the first option, which apparently, you know, if you look at U.S. history, there's almost been no years that U.S. hasn't been bombing, you know, or fighting somebody around the world. So that's our mission.
And I definitely want to double down on the nuclear proliferation piece, because I have some strong views on that. But tell us how you got involved, because obviously everybody who served doesn't feel the way the folks in Veterans for Peace does. But what made you say, I need to do something differently?
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in Fayetteville. Like I said, I'm from North Carolina. So I grew up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where Fort Bragg is. For a minute, it was called Fort Liberty. Now it's Fort Bragg again. But I grew up there. So all my life, between there and Fort Lee, which is in Virginia, I've been around military service. I've had uncles who served in the military, reaching the highest ranks of the enlisted personnel, being sergeant majors, first sergeants, master sergeants. You know, my stepfather was a Vietnam veteran when I was a kid, like 9, 10 years old. I saw what I didn't know at the time was post-traumatic stress in him, some drug addiction, alcoholism, things of that nature. So growing up in Fayetteville and, you know, being around families and soldiers, I have respect for soldiers as I was growing up, and I still do. I saw families, people taking care of their families as service members. My friends would get out of, I had older friends, so some of them would get out of school, they'd go into service and come back, and, you know, they're driving nice cars. And in Fayetteville, there's not a lot of opportunities, but one of the things you can do is go into the military. So most go into the military. I mean, out of my friends, I think maybe two didn't go in. So I've always wanted to serve people. I saw the military as a way to serve my country and to serve people. Now that I'm older, I realize there's other ways to serve, and that the things I knew that our country wasn't always doing the right thing, but I didn't really have an understanding, as most young people don't, the extent to which our policies around the world are wrong. I used to think that a war was a necessary evil. Now I see it more as a choice, especially in the United States foreign policy. For example, attacking Iran was not necessary. It was a choice. I've heard many commentators, and including generals on TV, talk about this was a war choice. So as I got older, realizing that war is more of a choice, and when George W. Bush came into office, he wanted to revive what at the time was called Star Wars, is a missile defense system. And I thought, after having fought in the first Gulf War, and the Soviet Union had fallen apart, so it was just, just Russia, I thought we had the opportunity as a nation to have a better relationship with Russia. I knew that the missile defense system would cause issues in that relationship, not only with them, but with China. So I was against that. Also, having grown up in the church and being taught that we are all children of God, and while I'm a Christian, I'm a heretic, so I don't, put one faith or non-faith down. I just want people to understand that.
Right.
Right, but I have absorbed those values. So I have a lot of respect, for all people. But when I got out of the military, I wasn't really looking at foreign policy until that thing happened with George Bush. But I was looking at how people were being treated, especially in my own community. My mother's a teacher, so she taught us U.S. history. She taught us Black history. I was very much aware of the struggle of my people in the United States. So I had started getting involved in issues here at home. So when I came to the peace movement, it was really, I went to the anti-war movement because I was already a person who believed in peace and saw peace as an umbrella, so to speak, for all the issues that we face here domestically, because they seem to me to be very similar, although they might impact us in different ways. And of course, each group of people have its own history dealing with the U.S. and capitalism and all those things. But it seems to be a multi-headed monster, that we're struggling against. So I saw as peace as an umbrella for all of that. And then with, as I said before, about the Star Wars initiative, that pushed me towards getting involved in what people call the peace movement, but in many ways I see it mostly as the anti-war movement. Then September 11 happened.
Oh, yeah.
And, the U.S. was going to war basically with almost everybody. So that's where I found Veterans for Peace. And I said to myself, well, I'm a veteran and I consider myself working for peace. So let me check this organization out. And I met who was then President David Klein. We became friends. And, from there, I just got deeply involved. And after a while, I became the executive director back in 2005. That was my first time at the ED.
And I think that was important because up to that point, I don't know that there was a face of color for Veterans for Peace, although I'm almost positive that I could count that there were folks of color who didn't agree with, foreign policy or military strategy, but who just didn't take that step. So I really appreciated your voice there as an authentic voice. And, you talked about, folks in your family being part of the military, and I certainly could say the same thing. I mean, my father was in the military. My stepfather was in the military, part of the Tuskegee Airmen. I got cousins that were part of, nephews, nieces, and so I am definitely anti-military and anti-war, but I'm also looking at our people who are going into those armed forces and who, as far as I'm concerned, get used as political fodder to carry out these imperialist wars. And what I tell people, these undeclared wars, and we can talk about this some more, We really haven't had to go into a justified war since World War II when we were fighting Nazism. Most of these other wars have been wars of aggression for territory, for resources. Do you agree with that?
Oh, most definitely. They've been wars of choice or ideological wars that were unnecessary. Vietnam is a perfect example of that. Even the Ho Chi Minh, after World War II, it reached out to the U.S. To be an ally, because I don't know, many of the listeners might not know, but Vietnam, before the Vietnam War of the U.S., it had been at war with France, because France was trying to control it as a colony. Mm-hmm. And before that, it had been at war with its neighbor for 1,000 years, okay? It had been struggling with China for 1,000 years, a long, long, long history of wanting to be an independent people. So in some ways, the war with the United States and France, I was a blink of an eye for them when it came to struggling to be independent. That's why one of the reasons they were so fierce when it came to fighting the U.S. So the reason I bring all that up is that they wanted to have a relationship with the U.S. In order to ensure that they could stay independent of China. But they also had socialist communist ideas about what kind of government they wanted to have. And the U.S., for racist reasons and also for ideological reasons, did not want to have a allied relationship with the Vietnamese. So next thing you know, the U.S. has decided to go to war with them. And you can just look at each and every conflict. Even some people might say, well, what about September 11th? And that's a good question. But was it necessary for us to go to war in Afghanistan? We could have done other things to try to find out exactly what happened. Even the Taliban at the time, who was running the country, who is running the country now, because we went to war and that didn't work out and we had to leave.
But the other thing about that, Michael, is that we found out later that the folks who were in those planes were not even from Afghanistan. So the justification, right. I mean, it was just bizarre the way that it was justified, and people were so confused. We were like, wait a minute, these folks came from this country, so why are we now trying to bomb Afghanistan? But again, this whole notion of, you know, our military is always fighting to defend the democracy of America, we find out that that is not true. And the more you uncover the onion, you see that we're in places that have nothing to do with defending the rights here. And I would go so far to say it's not been the military who's protected his rights. It's been organizations like the ACLU, the Organization for Black Struggle, Veterans for Peace, who have actually fought for human rights and civil rights in this country, not the military.
Well, that's definitely true. Every time I hear that, that's what comes to mind for me, that the people here are the ones to preserve our rights, not the military.
Right, right.
But Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan. So you know, just to be fair with people who might say we needed to attack Afghanistan, so my point being, no, we didn't, though, because we could have talked to the leaders of that country and found a different way. But you are also correct, though, that Osama bin Laden was from Saudi Arabia. And so the people who actually attacked the U.S. were not Taliban or Afghans, they were Saudis.
Right.
And this just gets back to the complicated world when it comes to how these countries relate to each other. But at the same time, it's not complicated because they're relating to each other in a way that wants to keep common people down. So they struggle with each other, right, over ways to gain power and keep power, while at the same time, keeping all of us down. Because there's not a lot of difference between working class people around the world.
Right.
There's not a lot of difference between, you know, the poor and the marginalized around the world. And again, there's not much difference between the rich and powerful around the world. They're all working together, struggling with each other,
mm-hmm.
no doubt, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they want to keep all of us down. So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right about who protects our rights. It's the people. and you, the movement.
Right, exactly. And also, you just made me think about the fact that some of the folks who are the most notorious about oppressing their people have been folks that the U.S. government has supported and financed. So sometimes people get confused. It's like, okay, we need to do something about them because they're oppressing their people. Well, those people were propped up by the U.S., and I would even say that about Israel. Israel could not exist had if not for the billions that we send to them every year, both in terms of military and humanitarian aid. And so these folks from Haiti to Israel, we have a hand in them becoming the monsters that they are, both to their countries and to the world.
That's exactly right. And again, an example that I was sent to fight against and topple was Saddam Hussein. You know, in the first Gulf War, the United States helped put Saddam Hussein into power.
Exactly.
And I know this to be true, not only from reading it, but at the beginning of what some people call the Second Gulf War or Iraqi Freedom, which is the last time we invaded, not long after the invasion, as a member of Veterans for Peace, I went to Iraq and I talked to Iraqis, sat down with Sunnis and Shia and people who weren't either. And they told me that Saddam would brag about having U.S. support and having been put into power. So then when Saddam decided he wanted to do his own thing, the U.S. decides, oh, well, we got to take you out.
No puppet here, so let's get rid of him. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And there's no doubt that he was oppressive and, you know, a dictator that did not just treat his people well. But it was all okay as long as he was doing what the people here in Washington wanted him to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you're totally right about how we support. The U.S. has supported dictators and then taking them out when they didn't continue to follow, you know, U.S. foreign policy.
And if the people ran them out, we provided, you know, safety and refuge for them, you know, including the Duvaliers out of Haiti. And so yeah, our hands are bloody. They're not just dirty. They are bloody with the blood of folks from all over the country. And I think sometimes it's hard for us to imagine our government doing these things in other countries. But yet it keeps coming out more and more. I mean, not the transparency of the government, but the, you know, people like, you know, organizations who are exposing them. You know, you got investigative media that's exposing them. It's not as hidden as it used to be in terms of the role of the U.S. in these places, particularly the CIA with regime change. And so when that term kept coming up with Iran and, you know, the Trump folks are like, oh, no, no, no. But then you say something like, well, if it's about regime change, then maybe, you know, it's like these subtle kinds of things. And that means for us that they already are looking at that as a military strategy to do regime change if they can't control the leaders over there. And so we also know, Michael, that there is a parallel military operations so that the U.S. government doesn't have to be constrained by what the military would be in terms of having to answer to Congress, having to do this. They contract some of the real dirty work out, and that came out with Black Hawks and all of these things. So people are becoming more aware of the tentacles of the U.S. military, the number of military branches all over the country, the number of military personnel, and how we are funding other people's military to continue to oppress their people under the guise that this is their national threat, or we have strategic interest in these different places, which is really not the case because we're still over in other people's lands. So you talked about going over to Iran and what we did there. And this whole notion that folks don't want them to have nuclear capabilities. And I think my view is similar to yours. Wait a minute. This is a sovereign country. We may not like that person. We may not agree with that person, but we have no right to come in, because then I'm thinking, okay, the U.S. is then would be subject to the same thing. Maybe somebody didn't like the fact that Trump is doing what they're doing. So do they have a right to come on our shores and do a regime change? I mean, really, this stuff gets to be contradictory after a while, like our rationale for being in these places. And it has not gone well for us, you know, for the U.S. government. I mean, even from Vietnam, we've not been winning. And we've also, in the world of public opinion, we've not won there either. So what is the end game for the military strategy that we keep seeing implemented over and over again?
Well, before I answer that, something that I think is important, because in the context of what we're talking about happening right now, that we need to make sure people know, and you brought up, is that, so why does Iran see the U.S. as an enemy? And it's important for listeners to know, and I'm sure many of yours do know this already, because I think, they keep up with this. But the U.S. Supported a coup in Iran in 1953, where Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown. And we supported the Shah of Iran being put into power. And then in 1979, he was overthrown because he was a oppressive person, although there were many what people might think of as liberal things that he introduced into the country. He also, first of all, they overthrew a democratically elected government. So the people had already decided who they wanted to be in power. Mm-hmm. So by overthrowing what the people wanted in power, that's oppression in and of itself. And then having to keep control, he had to oppress people. So the Iranian people haven't forgotten that. And the mullahs or the theocracy uses that against the United States. So that's our actions that created that animosity. That didn't have to be that way. So the seeds of what's happening today, we planted those seeds. Right. The West planted those seeds. And it's been exacerbated over the years. So when you say what the end game is, I don't know if there is really an end game except for amassing power and influence and trying to dominate the globe and continuing to have economic resources flow in one direction, you know, increasing certain people's power and wealth. Honestly, I think that's the end game. And people use the cover of spreading democracy, spreading freedom. But at the end of the day, it's really about what I said, economics. It's about power. That's what I believe. I don't see how, I mean, if you have certain principles, but in order to spread them, you violate them, then how could it really be about those principles? Right. It can't be.
You then make it apply to certain situations, but not all?
Through power, because who can stop you? Mm-hmm. That's what it all boils down to. And people, I would hope people could see that and stop allowing them to use, which are good principles when it comes to freedom and women's rights and, you know, making sure everyone is treated well, et cetera. Yeah, those are the things I agree with. But I don't think we should not be going to war to spread that. We shouldn't be toppling governments to spread that. That's not what you do. You should be an example. And if we're going to be an example, we need to be an example here at home. So let's start being an example in our own country and stop acting like that these principles that we claim we're trying to uplift and bring to the world, where we're not even doing it here.
Exactly.
You know, so that's madness.
Yeah. So when I think about that and I look at countries around the world, and if in fact people believe that the end game has nothing to do with preserving democracy in this country, then we are in fact stoking hostilities toward the U.S. And that means that we become vulnerable as a country and as a people, because I just think that if I was in another country and somebody was always bullying me and I see them bullying other people, I'm going to try to unite those folks to get rid of the bully. And if that means that the folks that are in that country are collateral damage, then so be it. So for us, and this is the thing that I've been really trying to raise up to people who seem to think that we as citizens and as voters are divorced from policies that our government is doing, when we are going to be victimized if somebody chooses to retaliate. What do you say about that?
Oh, well, we already have examples of that. So you're absolutely right. So just not even an altruistic or, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing, just on a pragmatic level, you're absolutely right. So September 11th, when those twin towers in New York were attacked and came down and thousands of U.S. people died, is a perfect example of what some people term as blowback. We should listen to the people, Osama bin Laden, as to why that happened. It's because of U.S. foreign policy that happened. And when we have people, you know, when they try, when I say they, the people who try to justify these things in terms of going overseas and attacking countries and trying to topple their leaders and stuff. And when they talk about the terrorism, they claim that people are just sitting at home and they look at the United States and they say, oh, I don't like the United States because of the way they live. So I'm going to go over there and do an act of terrorism.
Right.
Which makes no sense. Because no one is sitting at home, you know, looking at other countries and thinking, I don't like what they're doing, so I'm going to go over there and put myself in harm's way so I can try to. That's not what's happening. What's happening is we're doing stuff that impact them. And just like you said, they get mad and say, well, I need to do something about this. And then they make the choice to come here or try to get people who are here to do acts of what we call terrorism. And people should understand terrorism is just another tool of war. Mm-hmm. And people who usually use terrorism don't have the military, you know, they don't have the economic power, they don't have the things so they can create and have tanks and planes and stuff. So it's just another a way of doing war. So, so yes, you're absolutely right. We need to have a foreign policy that's good for us. But when they talk about protecting U.S. interests, they're really talking about protecting the interests of the rich and powerful to keep those resources and money flowing in a particular direction. And maybe the outcome of that will trickle down to average people like us, but more than likely, the bulk of it won't. So it's not in our interest. It's in a whole nother class of people's interest.
Yeah. Wow. So let's talk a bit about what happened with these bunker busting missiles that were sent to Iran, because I think now you have conflicting information about the success of that mission. And for folks who don't know, those bunker, it's almost like a tongue twister, the bumper.
Bunker busting, this
is one of the first times that they were used. Now, they've been developing for a while because what they have found out in that particular region is these folks go deep into the ground to do what they needed to do. And so they like, okay, we got to come up with this. The problem was with Israel is they don't have anything to carry those bombs. So guess who comes to their defense with the B-2s is the U.S.
Right.
But these bunker busting bombs, they cost a lot of money. And so because this was an experiment and now we are hearing drip by drip that they may not have obliterated, and I'm putting that in quotes, obliterated those facilities, of those three facilities that were bombed. So those, every time I look at one of those missions, I'm thinking my tax dollars, and I'm trying to remind people those are your tax dollars too. So we have a situation where the U.S., who said they weren't going to get involved, but because Israel said these folks are almost to the point of developing nuclear capabilities, Netanyahu's been saying this for at least the last 20 years. They're almost there. We don't do something. So I just saw recently this interview that Ted Koppel had with President. I don't know if he was president then, probably not. But Nixon said there will never be a U.S. president, Republican or Democrat, that's going to go against Israel. Well, now to hear that being said out loud was really unsettling, although I had pretty much come to that conclusion if you look at U.S. Foreign policy for and for Israel. But why do you think we have such a unconditional support for Israel? I mean, it is, you know, pretty much if they snap their fingers and say, you know, whatever, we say, you know, when, how, you know, we're there for you. This is a country that's so damn small. What could be their value to the U.S., except that over time, they have been successful, the Zionists have been successful at creating this narrative that the U.S. has to always be there for them. What is your take on this whole relationship that the U.S. has with Israel? And I will show you the Israel Zionist.
Okay. So before I answer that, I did want to say B-1 bombers cost about $2.1 billion each. Just talking about how much money is spent on the military. And those bombs, I've seen different numbers, like 3.5 million each to maybe as high as 20 million. And I guess that might include the research and development of them or something. I'm not sure.
But here's the thing, Michael, when I tried to look up how much each one of those costs, guess what it kept telling me? This is classified information. Oh, how could that be? The cost shouldn't be classified. Maybe the ingredients, but how are you going to tell me the cost is classified? That is absurd.
Well, you know, honestly, a lot of these designations are absurd. So it's not surprising. So I think that there's an intersection of many things that creates this situation when it comes to U.S. policy being in support of the state of Israel. Some of it is strategic because president, or I should say U.S. policy thinkers, have wanted to have someone in the region, a country in the region that it felt it could always rely on, because that Arab nations during the Cold War kind of leaned a little bit more towards Russia, and at times they leaned towards us. So they were up for a contest between the two. Saudi probably the least in some ways, because during World War II, I think, is when we told them we were always helped the Saudi family stay in power. So I think just on a strategic level, and Nixon actually might have been the least when it comes to some of this, because I can't remember where I read some things about some of the things that he said, but I think that's one thing. Okay, then you have this Christian Zionists, especially today, these Christian Zionists, because remember, there was a time where, especially before the State of Israel was came into being, and I guess what was it, 1948 or something?
Yeah, 48.
When the generally Christians were super anti-Jewish, and they almost, and I say Christians as in white Christians, were anti-Jewish. And next to black people, if you want to, you know, who did they seem to hate the most? You know, of course, us, and then probably Jews.
Mm-hmm.
But then after the creation of the State of Israel, over time, that's changed to where you have these Christian Zionists who believe, and there's more of them in the Republican Party and on the right than the Democrats, who believe that all the Jews are supposed to go back to Israel, and the temple is supposed to be rebuilt, which is where the, I think it's the Dome of the Rock, the mosque is where that's located. So that has to be torn down. Temple has to be rebuilt, and then Jesus is going to come back.
Mm.
So there was recently actually a discussion with Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson And it's really interesting. It's about an hour and a half long. But during the discussion, Ted Cruz brought up that in the Bible, we're commanded to support Israel, that those who support Israel, something like this is a verse, those who support Israel will be blessed and those who don't, something to happen to them, something like that. So there's a lot of people in the Republican Party who believe that. And so they believe that their salvation, and this is a really, really strong motivation when you believe this, that your salvation is tied to your support of the nation of Israel.
That's powerful.
Right. That's a real powerful incentive. And then the many of my Jewish brothers and sisters, wherever they stand on the spectrum of being a Zionist or not, have been traumatized by the Holocaust. So there's a large number who are going to support Israel because they feel like they, I've had Jewish people tell me that where do I need some place to go, which I always find to be kind of funny because when you're going to tell me as a black person, you in the United States of America, and you're going to tell me you need a place to go, how are you going to tell me that?
right.
Right. So, and to be clear in the audience, this what I'm talking about is not all Jewish people, because it's like Jewish Voices for Peace and Jewish people that I know that are not, you know, they actually don't care one way or another. I don't care about Israel, you know. So there's all kinds of, there's a spectrum of Jewish thought when it comes to Israel. So I want people to be clear on that.
Right.
But there is a large number of Jewish people who believe that Israel needs to be there for them. So since they believe that, politics creates strange bedfellows. So if there's another group of people who at the end of the day think that I'm supposed to be in Israel, but I'm not going there, but I think Israel needs to be there, you know, we can work together to make sure Israel is safe. You know, I might not agree with all the reasons you want to make sure Israel is safe, but you want to make sure Israel is safe. So I'm going to work with you. So there's this intersection of things. And then there's money.
Big money.
People give them money. Give them money. And some people try to say it's Jewish money, but no, because it is Jews who want Israel to be safe. But there's all kinds of other people's kind of money going back to these Christian Zionists who believe that their salvation is tied to Israel. They're giving money too. So it's not so simple as, and people start to get borderline anti-Semitic when they try to say that is Jewish money. No, it's pro-Israel money, and there's all kinds of people who support that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and APEC does have a strong voice, but the reason they have a strong voice is not just because of funds, it's because they're speaking to that feeling that many of these Christian Zionists have. If the Christian Zionists all of a sudden decided that they don't need the state of Israel or they don't need to support Jews that support Israel, APAC would not have does not have enough power to overcome the Christian Zionist voice. People need to understand it's the Christian Zionists that really push the major power behind that. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I believe that Israel is able to have so much voice when it comes to U.S. foreign policy.
Right. So if you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we have talking to us, trying to figure out all this militarization of not only of this country, but of the world. And we have Michael McPherson, who for many years was the local executive director of Voices for Peace, and now he is the national ED. And so he's been dealing with some of these issues for most of his adult life. He is my go-to person when it comes to really trying to separate what is a peaceful policy and what is a military policy. And, you know, one of the things, Michael, I try to tell people is at some point, the U.S. government was grappling with whether or not to call the Department of Defense the Department of Peace, as opposed to, you know, the War Department, the Department of War. And they opted for the war, which to me just sent it in a whole different direction. As you know, really opposing a peaceful path. And so if your thing is always going to be a military response, then everything fits into that, including budget, including a narrative, including getting your constituents to support a military. So it is a different reality that I think could have been very different had we had a Department of Peace. And so when I look at, for example, what's going on in Iran, other parts of the world, and the U.S.'s hand in that, I mean, most of these folks who are fighting for liberation in their own countries will say, what we need you all to do, if you all are truly interested and in concerned about supporting us, is to get your government out of our business. And so for us, and I know Voices, Veterans for Peace often has this position too, is really trying to get the government to pull out, to get them to not invest as much in the military. Now, the military has more money than any of the other agencies in this country. But that it is a mindset. If you always, or your first response is like to punch, as opposed to let me be thoughtful, let me count to 10, or whatever you need to do, it does take you sometimes really off the cliff. And so one of the things I think we have to determine here in this country is this whole notion, not just of the militarization of the world because of the use of U.S. military, but now we're starting to see that on the streets in this country, and the fact that U.S. Marines were deployed to deal with a domestic situation has to cause us to concern. And you had the little dictator in the White House saying, I can put troops in every major city, and we need to believe that he will and can. So how is this playing out? I mean, we saw, you were here when Ferguson, and we started to see some of those weapons that are supposed to be in the military environment starting to show up in urban settings. And so what is happening here? Explain from your point of view and the discussions that you all are having, because I think when people have been in the military who put their lives on the line under the auspices of fighting for the democracy of the U.S., you all have a perspective that I think needs to be heard and needs to be respected.
I appreciate that. I think everyone who's listening to your program, unless they're just listening to get some intel for something, knows that Trump has authoritarian, at a minimum, you could say tendencies, but I think that's basically just his approach, right? Dictatorship-like things. One of the things I think that he and his advisors and the plan is to do this thing that Steve Bannon called flood the zone, which means to just do a whole lot of things at one time because it throws those people off the balance. I think that's why in the short period of time that President Trump has been in office for the second time, we've seen so much stuff happen every day.
Every day.
So it makes it, every day. So it makes it difficult for us, you know, activists, et cetera, to respond, because we don't have unlimited money and we don't have unlimited resources and people like government does. So that's one thing that's happening. Also, he wants to, he believes in this thing and the people around him called unitary presidency, which means that the president has the ultimate power between the three branches, as opposed to those of us who believe, if you believe in our system, that the branches are co-equal. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing
and let me just interrupt you. And it's supposed to be checks and balances on the other two, which has been totally That's dissolved.
Right. And in part, and I'll say the other thing I'm going to say, in part is because Congress over, not just now, but over the years, has given up a lot of power to the president, especially when it comes to foreign policy, instead of trying to hold him accountable, and making him come to them before they do military actions. They haven't. They just let him do whatever he wanted. So one of the things that this is very different about the Trump administration, at least the way I see it, than others, is that when in the past, when Congress would appropriate funds for certain things, the president would go ahead and spend that money in those different agencies because Congress appropriates the money for whatever it is, Department of Defense or, you know, whatever those different departments are. And then there's sub agencies in those departments. And Congress is usually pretty specific about where to spend the money. So what the Trump administration, though, has decided is that it's just not going to be an administrator of the money. It's going to be an arbitrator of the money. Mm. So when the money comes in, it can decide if it wants to spend it, not necessarily following what Congress has deemed where the money should be spent. No president has done that. If they did do it, it was very limited. I don't know of any president who has decided, well, I'm not going to give this agency money and this agency money, even though Congress, you know, and the Republican Congress has decided to go along with it instead of saying, no, we appropriated this and you can't tell us that you're not going to spend this money.
Right.
So that's very different. And that's one of the biggest things that's happening right now. That hadn't happened in the past.
Yeah.
And then the third thing, because he believes in this unitary presidency and that he's the arbitrator or the decider of everything, when it comes to the military, he wants to use force in order to put forth, you know, his policies. And any dictator or authoritarian knows that in order for you to have the ultimate power that you're looking for, you have to bring the military along. Because the military, at the end of the day, doesn't go along with you, what are you going to do? Because that is about strength and power. So I think that the president is trying to increase his power when it comes to use of the military, to intimidate all of us, but also to normalize his ability to use the military in any way that he wants domestically.
Well, some of this should be backfiring on him. I know it's going to mean like people like us are lifting these issues up. So, for example, this whole immigration deportation of all, we're going to get rid of all the dangerous people, but yet every day on the news, people are seeing hardworking Latinas being, you know, trampled to the ground and beat. Yeah. And some of these folks are actually got family in the military. And it's like, what the is going on here? And so when we think about these policies and we get told one thing, because this, as I said at the beginning of the show, this man is a serial liar. He's a psychopathical liar. We were told only the most dangerous. We're going to get rid of these thugs. But everybody that we're seeing are people that are working hard, paying taxes, have blended into their communities as upstanding citizens, but yet they're being taken out. And so one of the things with this domestic peace, I just, you know, would like to hear your opinion about the use of the military, how our police are being militarized, because what's going on with Trump is going on the state level when you have Kehoe and the white legislators taking back local control of the St. Louis Police Department so that they can have more influence on how they are deployed on us. And so you got to connect the dots for people. So how do you see moving forward as citizens who are concerned about the direction of this country, that we're going more toward military and that everybody then gets a target on their back if they don't agree with the policies of whoever's in power?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. So, you know, Trump, when he won the first time, there was a movement that was looking for a leader, and he was the leader looking for a movement. And that movement was that far right that was always kind of there. But with President Obama coming into office, you know, we had that Tea Party movement and all these really racist people coming together and an ideology formed. And to be fair, some of it's economic anxiety created by the ruling class, you know, not taking care of working people. So I don't want to act like it's all just racism. Mm-hmm. It exacerbates that, right? So they were looking for somebody who would mouth or say the things that they were thinking that weren't acceptable to say by the people in power, be it Democrat or Republican. And Trump came along and he was saying what they were thinking. So the reason I bring that up is because there are a lot of people in the country, unfortunately, who are threatened by the demographic change in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And
which can't be stopped. It's unstoppable. The demographics are unstoppable.
I know it is, but they're afraid. So they're willing to do things, like they're willing to push all kinds of principles and stuff aside because of this fear mm-hmm. that they have. And then there's people who want to take advantage of that in order to stay in power, which is one of the things Trump is doing. But there's all these other low-level local places and all of that. Then talking about the people there in Missouri trying to take back, you know, power in terms of taking of the police and all that. You know, so it all ends up coming together, you know, in many different levels. And so that's how an authoritarian state is built, you know. And so what we have to do is interrupt all of that, come together as a community across the a spectrum of the different, you know, we have different ideas about how to get things done on the left, right? So, but we got to just come together and figure and understand who the opposition is. We're not in opposition to each other, really. We just got different ideas about things. Mm-hmm. But we want to see a very similar world. These people want to see a different kind of world than we want to see. So earlier you said, keep our eyes on the prize. Well, remember, we have to remember that mm-hmm. instead of arguing with each other mm-hmm. about how to get there. Mm-hmm. Because they don't care about if one of the things I said about us arguing on the left with each other, if they put us in jail, they're not going to ask right, the difference right, between right. the socialists and right. the Democrats. They're mm-hmm. not going to ask all that, right? Mm-hmm. We'll just be all in jail together. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand that. And work together, because there's more of us than there is of them. We have a better vision that includes everyone. It even includes them. You mm-hmm. just can't, it's, you know, because, yeah, it includes everybody. So we have to work together. Now, when it comes to the military, it can backfire, and I think it will. I know that organizations like Military Law Task Force, GI Rights Hotline, the Center on Conscience and War, and these are organizations that help service members when they want to become conscience objectors, or if they think that they're possibly doing something that's illegal or whatever, you know, they give them some information and help them think about what they're doing. So they're getting a lot more calls, which means a lot of service members are uncomfortable with what they're seeing. Mm-hmm. Then there's a whole other group of service members who are just not going to do what the Trump administration is going to ask them to do. And then depending on how bad it gets, they'll start to be real ideological, because even the Trump administration is stoking these things because, you know, he likes to stoke stuff. So when he had that, he did that speech in Fayetteville, North Carolina for Bragg. And he had soldiers behind him, yeah, and he was saying yeah. things, and they were whooping and hollering. Mm-hmm. Well, there's plenty of soldiers that disagree with the things he was saying. And see, that's another thing about him. No president that I know of would go make such a political speech with service members. No president that I know of, even though we all might disagree with things, but didn't actively try to stoke a vision to the degree that this guy is. Mm-hmm. So what he's doing is creating more risk even within the military itself.
Right.
So I don't know when or how, depending on how far I go, it'll fall apart. But it's not going to be so easy. Like, people just going to in lockstep. Some people will, but there's going to be people who are going to say, no, I'm not going to do that. They're not going to be in lockstep, come out here and start shooting people. You know, some people are willing to do that, but there's others who are not willing to do that. And if that time comes, we'll have to see how that goes down. But in the meantime, there are efforts to talk to service members. So there's an effort out there called Don't Turn on Us. Mm. And the idea is to get information in the service members' hands, or at least make it visible to service members asking them basically not to turn on us. And organizations like Veterans for Peace and About Face Veterans Against the War are developing efforts to educate service members not only about not following the illegal orders, but asking yourself, if even if this order isn't illegal, does it go against my own conscience? If I do this, how am I going to feel after? Right. Am I going to have what they call moral injury? Mm. You know, so we're trying to make sure that service members are thinking about what they're asked to do, and that even if it's illegal, is it right? Do you feel it's right? Mm-hmm. Because you have to live with yourself at the end of the day, you know?
Right. And so I think that's a good point to leave on, because when we look at this country and where it's going, what is our moral and social and political right. obligation to make it worthy of citizenship, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50 years from now? And right now, right. if we don't do something fairly drastic on our part in terms of organizing, then we're going to have what we have, and that's not going to be good for the folks. So I definitely want to thank you for joining us today, Michael McPherson.
Thank you.
And we'll see what happens with the Veterans for Peace, and be looking to them for some real leadership going forward. For those of you all who didn't get to hear all of this, you know, you can always go to JamalaRogers.com and pull this as well as any past shows. Thank you for listening, and this is Jamala Rogers, and I will see you on the battlefield.